You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Welcome to The Spear, the podcast about the combat experience, brought to you by the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm your host, Tim Heck, and today I'm joined by Major John Borman, a boxing instructor here at West Point in the Department of Physical Education. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
What brought you into the Army in the first place?
So why did I join the Army? So way back in 1998, I was in high school, didn't really know what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I decided, hey, I'm going to apply to University of Wisconsin-Madison. Got rejected. So scrambling, hey, what do I do now? Decided, hey, let me go talk to some recruiters. So went down to the combined recruiting station, had my set on being a Marine. I was going to go join Marines, be a Marine recon, do some amazing things. They looked at me and they laughed. They said, I'm too little to be a Marine, right? So I said, okay, go talk to the Navy. So I went over and talked to the Navy guy. Told him, hey, I want to be a Navy SEAL. He laughed. He said, nah, that's not how it works. You don't just get to join up and be a Navy SEAL. He said, you need to go talk to the Air Force. Okay, so walked down the hall, talked to the Air Force recruiter. And at the time I had glasses on. And he said, well, you can't fly if you got glasses. So I said, well, I don't want to do anything if I'm not flying. So I was getting ready to head back home, and the Army recruiter said, hey, come talk to me. So I went in. He showed me an amazing video, the Be All You Can Be, with a tank driving, jumping over a few obstacles. And he said, hey, you ever thought about joining the Army? I said, never. He said, well, come on. Let's go see what you qualify for. So went up, took the test, and they said, hey, come in, join, be a tanker. 4 years, we'll give you $10,000, and drive around, blow stuff up. It's going to be amazing. I said, okay, let's do it. So told my mom, she signed on the dotted line and signed up for 4 years.
You went to basic training. You went to Fort Knox. Was it all the video promised it could be?
It was interesting, right? So I went to Fort Knox. Big expectations, right? I was 17 when I joined the Army. So I turned 18 in basic training, getting smoked in a PT pit, right? And I was like, what did I sign up for? Tankers are not really the smartest out there, right, for enlisted. So it was a very interesting dynamic of people that I was working with. My experience at basic was a lot of fun. I got to do a lot of really cool things, but it wasn't really what I expected. So for me, I was more anxious to when I would get to a unit and kind of really see what it was about. I had a lot of fun. I didn't mind the hard work. I'd been raised on a farm, so I knew how to work hard. I didn't mind all the PT. I didn't mind all the yelling. I didn't mind the job at all. I did have some heartbreak, though. I was all set to get promoted. I was supposed to get two promotions, and my second promotion that I was earning, I got no-go'd because my pants were too long. So I went in front of the board, and they kicked me out because of a uniform violation. So I was not happy. So I left there. When I got finished with basic, headed down to Fort Hood. So,
who did you join at Fort Hood?
Yeah, so when I got down to Fort Hood, I joined the 1st Cavalry Division, and I was in Charlie Company, first of the 12th Cav. So, yeah, so my job originally, I was a tank crewman, so I was a tank driver. So I drove tanks for them, and then shortly after getting there, we deployed in 99 to Bosnia. So when we were in Bosnia, we're on Humvees driving around. So I was a driver for the duration of that deployment.
How long did you spend in Bosnia?
We were in Bosnia for 9 months.
And what was your primary mission?
Yeah, our primary mission was peacekeeping. So we were out of Camp McGovern, and we'd do, you know, presence patrols. We'd go do weapons inventories. We were there when Kosovo kicked off, so we got to help secure the border. We were there when we shot down one of the Russian MiGs, so we got to go secure the site for that. So it was a pretty interesting time, but most of our time there was real low threat, just peacekeeping and doing kind of security checks.
After you left Kosovo, what happened in your Army career?
Yeah, so came back, got promoted rather quickly, and went through some boards, did really, really well, decided, hey, I'm going to give this Army thing a shot, right? Instead of just doing the 4 years, going home, going back to school, decided, hey, let me just kind of see where I can take this. And then stayed in Charlie 112, didn't move. And then, of course, 2001 hit, Twin Towers go down. So we're like, okay, hey, war on terror. We're going to start training up because we don't know where we're going to deploy. And then about early 2003, we were notified, hey, Iraq's kicking off. 4th ID is going to go first. 1st Cav's going to go in and take their place. So that's what the focus became was, okay, we're going to train up to roll into Iraq and handle business in 2004.
At that time, are you a tank commander?
Yeah, so by then I was a tank commander. I was in White Platoon, 2nd Platoon. We were known as the Fat Bastards. So we have 4 tanks, and when we were training up, the intent was to have tanks. We were going to be on tanks, in theater, patrolling, route recons, all that sort of stuff. About 3 months, maybe 4 months prior to deployment, we were notified that out of the company of 3 platoons, only 1 platoon would have tanks, and the other 2 would be on Humvees. So 1st platoon wound up being on tanks. 2nd and 3rd platoon wound up having a transition to Humvees. So I went from having 72 tons of steel to a thin-skinned Scout Humvee.
What was that transition like mentally?
It was tough, right? It was one of those, we were very, very good on tanks. We knew tanks. I knew tank tactics. We were very well trained. I had won, you know, best tank in the battalion awards a couple times. So I was very, very adept at maneuvering tanks and firing with tanks, had never really spent much time on dismounted tactics. So the entering and clearing a room, sweeping for IEDs, those sorts of things had never crossed my mind until we're notified, hey, you're going to deploy. And also now we've got to switch over to the light fighter mentality of, okay, now we've got to figure out how to do these techs, snap checkpoints, enter and clear room, those types of tests.
As a tank leader, do you now become a squad leader?
Yeah, so, yep, so the way it works, yep, I've got basically a squad, so they take our platoon, we've got still the 60-man platoon, but I kind of divide it into a section, so you've got my gun truck, and then the platoon leaders, and then you have the platoon sergeant's truck with his other sergeant out there, so.
And what kind of training did you go through?
Yeah, so the train up, a lot of your typical train up, right, so gunnery densities, qualifications, shoot houses, a lot of dismounted training. We did an NTC rotation. We did some mount training, urban mount training at mount sites, getting used to dismounted training, patrolling, react to contact, identifying counter sniper type missions, really trying to understand all of the unique aspects of being dismounted and having to communicate and having to make decisions on the fly. So quite an extensive train up just prior to deployment.
Did you find that training more difficult than initial tank training, or just different animals entirely?
Yeah, well, 2 different animals. I would say the complexities and the speed of maneuver, right? So in a tank, you have time to react, right? There's distance between you and the enemy. You have time to think about it. You have time to maneuver. You have time to react. You also have a protective element where if they take a shot at you, it might not be a catastrophic kill. When you're dismounted, that flash to bang is a whole lot less. So you have to be a lot quicker on your actions, and you have to be more synced, right? So if a couple of tanks are driving too close to each other, hey, you can spread out the space. If you're walking too close to each other and someone drops a hand grenade or an IED goes off, now you've lost your entire squad. So the speed at which things happen and then the complexity at which things happen, right? So 360 on an individual is a lot more to really focus on, right? So that being aware of your surroundings at all times becomes that much more amplified when you're dismounted.
How did your soldiers react to the training?
They reacted well. We had a great team, very tight-knit crew. We'd been working together. All of us had been together about 2 years, so we all knew each other, and we all had each other's backs. Very, very tight-knit crew. So we knew that regardless of what the situation was, we all had each other's back.
When did you wind up deploying?
Yeah, so we wound up deploying in early 2004. We left the States in March, initially pushed up into Kuwait, staged there, and then wound up driving vehicles from Kuwait up into Baghdad. So April 1st of 2004 is when we arrived in Baghdad.
Who did you replace?
Yeah, so when we got there, we took over our responsibilities at Camp War Eagle, just outside of Sadr City. And at the time, we had 10th Mountain was there, and that's who we ripped with.
Did you replace another tank platoon, or?
No, so they were dismounted. So yeah, 10th Mountain, they were dismounted running ops with their doors off, pretty much just presence patrol. When we took over from them, they hadn't had really any danger in the area. The Mahdi militia was kind of calm at the time. So they assured us the first day we got there that it would be a nice, quiet, kind of peacekeeping mission for us. They said, hey, look, the sector is calm. They had minimal firefights in the past 3 months, and they felt like they had kind of a good handle on it. So when they were handing it over to us, they thought, hey, this is going to be kind of a nice, easy peacekeeping mission for you guys. All of the fighting is over.
And did you believe them?
We did at first, right? Because we got in there, and it was pretty quiet, right? The ride-up was pretty uneventful from Kuwait to up into Baghdad. You know, not much excitement. When we got there the first night, no real contact, nothing, you know, really there. So you kind of get the sensation, okay, hey, it's all the fighting's over, and we're just here to help rebuild. That quickly disappeared, though. If you go back and look, April 4th, 2004, so 4 days in theater, that's when kind of the hornet's nest got stirred up, right? So, can't remember the lady's name. Martha Raditz, I think is her name, wrote a story on it. So 2.5 Cav was attached with us. So we had both 112 Cav and 2.5 Cav had Camp War Eagle, kind of split base ops. And on April 4th is when Muqtada al-Sadr, the leader of the Mahdi militia, decided that, hey, we're going to declare war on the American troops, right? So that day, one of the missions had been to basically take out his deputies. And in response to that, the army decided they were going to take over some police stations. So in the process of reclaiming stations, there's a very big ambush. So there's a book about it called The Long Road Home. Basically 2.5 Cav went out, got rolled up in a pretty bad ambush, lost a lot of soldiers, had a lot of wounded. And during that mission, my platoon, we were out kind of holding down the fort on Route Predators, one of the main routes kind of in and out of the base camp there, with no communications, just holding our ground, waiting to kind of react to contact. So at that point, we quickly understood that, hey, this is not going to be just an easy peacekeeping mission. This is not going to be a repeat of Bosnia. This is going to be a matter of, okay, we've got to get control of the city and kind of the outlying area.
On the 4th of April, did you wind up leaving that blocking position?
No. On the 4th of April, we wound up holding it down the whole night. So we were out there for about 12 hours holding our position. Maintaining, making sure no one got in, no one got out until the sun came up. And by then, the fighting was over. We were able to get relieved, roll back in. We had no clue what kind of casualties 2.5 had taken at the time. We heard all the firefights going on, but it was impossible to tell who was shooting at who and who was doing what. But yeah, we didn't know until we rolled back and started getting the reports of what had gone down the night before.
What did those reports make you think?
Those reports made me think that, holy cow, this is serious. This is what we trained for, but this is not going to be an easy deployment. The reports made me think that, okay, we we have our work cut out for us. And at that point, I told my guys, look, this is not going to be easy. This is not going to be a walk in the park like they briefed us. And just be prepared to have to do some tough things.
Did your company and platoon leadership reinforce that message?
They did, yeah. So luckily, my platoon sergeant, Sergeant First Class Gustafson, great leader, really had a good level head on himself and just knew that, hey, look, guys, we need to double down. Platoon leader was a great historian, right? So huge fan of history and tactics and knew, hey, look, like, we've got the training, we've got the equipment, we're going to be just fine. We just need to kind of focus on each mission as it comes, each day at a time, each task at a time, and just do our job to the best of our ability. The command team just emphasized, hey, if we do the right thing at the right time, it'll all take care of itself, right? So trust the training, trust the people to your left and right, and you'll be just fine.
Your conditions at War Eagle, you were sharing it with another CAV. Were you living in tents, living in squad bays? What was
yeah,
it like?
Yeah, so Camp War Eagle, when we first rolled in, we were living in tents. So they had the big, massive, we call them funeral tents, because that's when they would set them up, and the locals would set them up for funerals and other events. So just massive tents. A lot of us were sleeping just under the stars. They built, while we were there, they wound up building barracks for us to move in. But the conditions were decent. The problem was mortars, right? So we would get rained down day and night, incoming in direct fire. And actually, Mother's Day of 04, I think we still have the Guinness World Record for the amount of rounds received in a single day. But some over 100 rounds impacted within our wire on Mother's Day. So, yeah, that was interesting. You just get used to that indirect fires coming at you.
Did your unit take casualties from those?
So we would take a lot of wounded, right? So a lot of people would take, shrapnel. We took some losses to equipment. But no, at least to my knowledge, no one was KIA. I don't think we ever lost anyone to indirect fire, just wounded, right? We had a lot of folks that would get wounded walking through. Stuff would get kicked up and they wouldn't drop. They wouldn't get to cover. But I don't think we lost anyone.
And while all that's going on, are you doing regular patrols?
Yes. Yeah. So the whole time, basically from April throughout the deployment, we're rolling out on different types of patrols. So we're running route recon. So we're looking, doing active IED sweeps, looking for any danger. We're doing presence patrols. We're going out into the community, trying to do weapons buyback program. We're distributing water supplies, food supplies. We were going on missions for entering clean rooms, intel gathering, and then also counter-mortar OPs, so trying to set in position to ambush the folks that are setting off indirect fires.
You're a sergeant at this time, correct?
I was a staff sergeant at the time, yep.
As a squad leader, as a staff sergeant, what was your daily life like?
Yeah, so as a staff sergeant, my role, I was basically the wingman for the platoon leader and the platoon sergeant, right? So my responsibility was ensuring everyone was ready for mission. So when we get ready for mission, I was helping to organize the mission briefs. When we come back from mission, we'd be doing resupply and restock. I was kind of the one that was helping to ensure that everything was ready to go, right? So in the Army, we use pre-combat checks and inspections. So that rested primarily on me. I'd get guidance. And while the platoon leader and platoon sergeant were plotting out mission plans, I'd be out making sure gun trucks were up and ready, radios were filled with communications, ammunition was ready, and that everyone knew their positions and they knew what type of mission we were getting ready for.
What kind of leadership challenges did you face in that role?
Yeah, so in that role, not really any leadership challenges out of the norm. Really, for me, the toughest thing was keeping people focused, right? It's really, really hard when you're in a dynamic environment like that where every time you roll out the gate, there's a danger at any spot, right? Whether it's an IED, whether it's an ambush, whether it's a sniper. It's really, really hard to keep discipline. It's really, really hard to keep your troops motivated, right? So trying to show them, hey, look, we're having an impact. What we're doing matters. What we're doing is needed. that was really the big challenge, is keeping everyone motivated to keep going out and kind of doing the same thing. It becomes Groundhog's Day, and just letting them know that, hey, look, there is an end in sight, I think was really the hardest challenge.
When you'd go out on these patrols, was it just your platoon or did you have attachments?
No, so normally we would just go out in the platoon. Sometimes we would do, if it was a bigger mission, we would have support. So at times we would run joint missions with either Bradley's or tank support if we needed it. But for the most part, the majority, I would say 90% of our missions were platoon led.
As the deployment goes on, does the Mahdi Army increase its violence against you, or was April 4th the high water mark for that?
No, yeah. So April 4th, we had hoped that was a high water mark. After April 4th, it kind of died down. But in around mid-July to early August, we saw a steady kind of increase, right? So what I like to say is, as the temperature rose, so did the aggressions, right? So as it started getting hot and angry over there, the Mahdi Army started getting hot and angry. So August is really when their op tempo kicked up. And that's when they were trying to pick fights with us actively.
And what did that look like from a tactical perspective?
Yeah, so from a tactical perspective, our tactics changed dramatically. So an increase in kind of counter-mortar OPs, right? An increase in reconnaissance and an increase in trying to actively run down the army. So the nice thing about the Mahdi Army is you knew when they wanted to pick a fight. So what they would do is they would go out to the streets, pile up some tires, and let them on fire, right? That's their kind of symbol of, hey, guys, come on out. We want to play. So that kind of started for us. That's when we knew, okay, hey, we're going out for action. Like, we're going to be going out. We're going to be getting some contact. We're going to be finding ourselves in a fight if we go near the action. So from a tactics point, that's where we shifted from just kind of a reactive mode to more of a proactive mode. All right, now we're going out assuming that there's going to be a fight versus going out, and if a fight happens, it happens.
What did those fights look like?
Yeah, so early on, the fights were kind of simple ambushes, right? So usually triggered by an IED, right? A remote detonated or a wire-based IED that they'd blast to get you to stop, and then pop up with a couple of soldiers and burst off a couple of rounds and run away. As we got into August, they became more complex. For example, kind of the day I got hit, that was probably one of the most complex kind of attacks that we had come across. Prior to that, about 2 weeks prior, we had been rolling sort of a route reconnaissance that turned into a very big ambush with multiple IEDs in place designed to take out the tanks. So that day, the armor guys had been out rolling route recon, and just about every 100 meters, they're running into double-stacked IEDs. And that wound up becoming a pretty long day with a lot of dismounted action. We had a lot of RPG attacks. We had a lot of ambushes, and QRF, the Quick Reaction Force, had been called up. So we were out there supporting them, trying to help seal off areas and help kind of provide coverage, poking into the alleyways where the tanks couldn't, trying to flush out the soldiers that were out there.
You mentioned getting hit.
Yeah, so August 11, 2004 is the day that kind of my luck ran out, right? So up until that point, our platoon and even our company had been very, very lucky. We had taken minimal casualties, and the casualties we had taken were primarily from IED and indirect. We hadn't lost anyone. We had one staff sergeant who had taken some concrete to his thigh from IED blast, and we'd had a few gunners that had been kind of knocked out from concussive blasts, but no one had really sustained any significant injuries. So when you're seeing that kind of success for that long, and we'd been in basically every type of firefight you can imagine, and coming out without any wounds, you start kind of feeling like you're Superman, right? You're like, hey, nothing can hurt me. These guys are horrible. We're going to kick their ass all the way up and down the street. And then August 11th happened, and I remember the mission was simple. It's supposed to be a nice, easy 4-hour counter-mortar mission. We're going to go out to our main checkpoint. We're going to set up an observation post and wait for the guys to start launching mortar rounds on the FOB. And we were hoping that we'd pick the right checkpoint so we'd be able to get eyes on, maneuver on them, take them out. And we get ready to roll out the gate. And we notice, hey, the fires are lit. So I told my guys, all right, hey, be ready, be on the lookout. You know, they're going to be feeling froggy. Roll out the gate, get to our checkpoint, and maybe 2 minutes after we arrive, we start taking indirect fire. Not the FOB, us, on our position. Very, very well-aimed indirect fire at that. Good enough to where one of the rounds impacted directly behind my Humvee and flattened both my rear tires. So we're like, okay, now I've got two flat tires. We probably need to head back to the base camp, get this vehicle fixed. Call to the base camp, and the leadership that was running the battalion said, hey, you know what? We would like to get some QRF up there, so can you guys just fix in place, and we'll get you guys some reinforcements. So at the time, I had a spare on the back of my truck, and we had a spare on the back of my platoon leader's truck. So we drove about a block away, tucked into an alleyway, and swapped out both tires on the trucks, right, and got it back up. We had about 30 minutes left for our mission to be complete. So talking to my platoon leader and platoon sergeant, we said, okay, hey, you know, that was fun. Like, we got 30 minutes left. What do we want to do? And at the time, we're like, hey, let's see if we can see what's happening. So we're like, all right, we'll go get eyes on and start reporting because tanks should be rolling by now. So we leave our position, roll up about 500 meters into kind of a clearing. Somewhere we had patrolled, we had sat numerous times before, right? Something we were very, very familiar with. The second we get stationed there, kind of all hell breaks loose, right? So we knew something was up because as we're rolling up, I call it a soccer field, but basically just a clearing right there near the road. We saw a group of guys that were hanging out, which is not that peculiar because there'd been guys that they get there, they play soccer games, they get there, they have meetings. So we're rolling up and we're like, okay, well, you know, maybe it's a meeting. And normally the Mahdi Army wears their little uniforms, right? They we call them the guys in the black pajamas. So usually very identifiable. These guys were not wearing black pajamas. So I was like, okay, it might have just been the locals thinking, hey, it's safe to come back. Maybe, you know, the fighting's done. But as we rolled up closer, they got a view of us and split. And I called it up. They didn't have weapons, so we couldn't engage them. So literally it was me, my platoon leader, my platoon sergeant, three gun trucks. Like, all right, guys, we got to try to get eyes on where they went to, right? So I pulled up into a good observation position. My platoon leader and my platoon sergeant pulled off to the left of me. And we're like, all right, we got to try to get eyes. Where did they go? And no sooner had we made that call to when the ambush started, right? So little did we know, we had literally pulled in to a U-shaped ambush. So they had us left, right, and front. They had us basically pinned down. They were lobbing mortar rounds behind us, so we couldn't back out of there. They were shooting RPGs, machine gun fire, on our position, right? So at that point, our only option is we've got to shoot our way out, right? And it was hard because you're trying to get a trace on where they're at, where is our point of penetration, where can we move to. At the same time, we have the gunners just laying waste to the spaces that these guys are in, trying to get a lull in the fire. But the problem was we were running through ammunition quick, right? So in the middle of it, I got a call, hey, gunners are running low on ammo. My gun truck has the case of ammo in the back, so I had to get out, go to the back, bust open a case, run a couple ammo cans over to the truck so that way they could, you know, continue suppressing fire. Got back, my gunner's out, so now I got to come back around, get more ammo, give it to him. And as I was coming around my truck, I noticed that there's two guys trying to flank us, right, coming up on our right side, so my right side. One's carrying an RPG, one's carrying an AK. And I remember thinking, oh, shit, like, if they hit us from the flank, thin skin Humvee, we're done. So I'm engaging. I told my driver, hey, we need to back up and maneuver because we're about to get overrun. And I remember looking to my side thinking, this is not going to end well. And I remember shooting at them, and I heard an RPG fired from my front. So I shout out to my gun truck, hey, RPG, RPG, so my gunner can pop down. And then it just hit me like a baseball bat. And what had happened was there was a sniper that was across the street in an elevated position in the mosque, had taken a shot at me, right? So basically with one single shot, went straight through my windshield, hit me in the left side of my cheek, lodged in my right cheek, and the copper jacket had basically gone in my throat and severed a bunch of nerves. I didn't realize it, right? Felt like I'd been hit with a baseball bat. And I remember I went blank for a second, and then I came to and I thought our vehicle had been hit, right? I thought we'd been hit by the RPG because my vision was all blurry. And I remember I looked out, and I noticed, no, the guy that had the RPG was down. So I was like, okay, he didn't shoot it. He's down. His buddy's trying to drag him off. So I'm like, okay, that didn't happen. And then I remember I was trying to call on the radio to my platoon sergeant to tell him, hey, look, we've got an area. I've got this cleared. We've taken out this alley. We can maneuver out. And my platoon leader kept coming back with, hey, I can't understand you. And what had happened was the impact had dislocated my jaw, so I wasn't talking properly. And so my driver looked over at me and grabbed the microphone, so I thought he was just going to relay. And he's like, hey, you're hit. So I put my hand up to my face, and I pull it back, and it's literally just covered in blood. So I'm like, oh, this isn't good, right? No pain, though, because it severed all the nerves, but I was like, this is not good. So in my mind, I'm going through like, okay, what the heck am I supposed to do now? So luckily, my gunner calls up, hey, White 2's hit. We need a medic over here. So Doc Murray jumps out. I run around to the back of the Humvee. He tells me, hey, sit down. Gives me this big pad, right? The stomach pad. He's like, hey, put this up to your face. I'm like, that's not good, right? That's for like, if your guts are hanging out, that's what you use. I'm like, this is not good. And he stabs me in the leg with some morphine. And he's like, hey, we need to get you out of here. And I remember thinking like, this sucks. Cause I didn't know it was my face. I thought it was my neck. And I used to teach first aid, right? And you always talk about, hey, let's put a tourniquet on it, right? That's how you stop the bleeding. Well, what happens when you're bleeding from your neck? You can't put a tourniquet on your neck because then you're just going to kill yourself. So I remember thinking like, holy shit, like the same thing I used to joke about now it's going to become reality. Like now I'm going to be one of those casualties. And I went over and my platoon sergeant, he had an up-armored Humvee. So they're like, hey, get in the back of there. It's going to be safer. We were still taking indirect fire. We were still taking RPG rounds. So I remember going back, sitting in there and just thinking, holy crap, like I cannot die here in this desert. And my platoon sergeant asked me, so Sergeant Gus asked me, he's like, hey man, how you doing? And I just told him, I said, I'm not doing good, because I knew it was getting bad when I started shivering, right? So it's 120 degrees outside, middle of August, like I knew right then I was going into shock. And I just was trying to tell myself, all right, remain calm, it'll be okay, it's not that bad. And luckily, at the time, he's calling it in for 9-line medevac. The rest of the company was already rolling out the gate. So they're like, hey, look, guys, we got it. You guys can go ahead and maneuver out, get Borman medevaced, and we'll handle the rest. So luckily, they got me back to the base camp, put me on a helicopter, medevaced me down the green zone, couple of emergency surgeries, stopped the bleeding. 7 surgeries later, I was fixed. On that mission, tanks rolled out, Bradley's rolled out. Basically, the entire base camp wound up rolling out for most of that day to really reclaim the sector. One of my other buddies, Staff Sergeant Young, was on a tank. He wound up taking an RPG round to the lung, survived, made a full recovery with me back in the States. His loader took a shrapnel from the RPG to the face, wound up recovering. We had one of the NCOs from the other companies lost his calf to some injury. So it was probably one of our heavier lost days that day. So very busy aid station, very kind of busy kind of time, which is crazy. So, and the nuts part is I wasn't even supposed to be there that day, right? I was supposed to be at home on R&R leave because my little sister was getting married. So literally, I wasn't even supposed to be in theater when I got hit. So it was one of those, like, holy cow. But, yeah, wound up getting medevaced up to Germany and then back to the States. A bunch more surgeries to fish out the bullets and the fragments and really put me back together. So,
you talked about the company rolling out. Did you know that was happening at the time?
No. So I had no idea what was happening behind the scenes. I just knew, because for my vehicle being just at the platoon, all I had was platoon comms. So I just knew what was happening between our gun trucks. So I didn't have any knowledge of what they were sending up to the company. I was sending up reports to the platoon leader and platoon sergeant on the platoon net. So just letting them know what I had in my sector, telling them about the guys on the rooftop, guys on the ground. And so no clue whether help was coming. So for us, we just figured, hey, we've just got to hold our ground until we either take everyone out or until we run out of ammo and have to evac out of there. So no idea. And for me, I was thinking like, hey, we had been notified when we took our rounds to the Humvee that they were going to roll the QRF. So I figure, well, maybe the QRF got diverted, right? Maybe there was some other action going somewhere else because they should have been out there before we even had kind of gotten into position. So for me and the three guys on the truck, we were like, okay, hey, we're not getting help. Like we just have to hold our own and fight through it.
Psychologically, what did that do to you?
It gives you kind of at first a sinking feeling, right? It's that holy shit. Because in your mind, like from a tactic standpoint, you know when you have the advantage, right? You know, hey, if you have the element of surprise, you know if you have the numbers, you know if you have the high ground. And when you find yourself in that ambush, like that's when you're just playing in your mind like, oh shit, this is when if I was them, I would be laying waste. Like no one's surviving this. And then so you get that very brief moment of, oh shit, right? You get what I call the pucker factor. Like, damn, this is, we messed up, we made a mistake, and now we have to try to fix it very quickly. And then very quickly, it transitions to, all right, these assholes don't know how to shoot very well. These assholes don't know how to use their weapons very well. So now it becomes, how can I flip the script on them? How can we safely execute knowing that they no longer have the advantage of surprise? And that we're starting to really nail down their positions. So that's, what felt like probably an hour happened in the course of minutes, right? You go from, oh shit, to, all right, well, it is what it is, to, okay, let's handle business.
And was it during that let's handle business when you got hit?
Correct, yeah. So let's handle business, that's when we're firing back, taking people out. And that's when I got hit, so...
You went over to your platoon sergeant's vehicle. Is that who you rode back with?
Yeah. So they wound up medevacing me in his vehicle. They thought it'd be the safest route. He had an actual upper armor Humvee. Mine was thin skin, so all I had was fiberglass doors and a plexiglass windshield. So they thought, hey, you're already hit. We can't run the risk of if I take an IED blast or an RPG to the vehicle. They wanted to make sure that, hey, they can get me back.
Who from your vehicle stepped up in your absence?
Yeah, so in my absence, my driver and gunner stepped up, so they were able to kind of keep rolling. The beautiful thing about a tank is everyone knows everyone's job, right? So in the absence of one or two people, the mission still continues, right? So really, you just need two bodies on a gun truck to make the mission happen, a driver and a gunner. So luckily, they were able to just continue laying down suppressive fire, help cover the move, and then move out with us as we move back to the base camp.
The corpsman had injected you with morphine. Did that interfere with your ability to process what was going on around you?
A little bit, yeah. So the weird thing about the morphine, right, is it deadens the pain and it kind of slows down time, right? So I had a lot of time to kind of sit and process what was happening and really come to realization of the situation, right? So as you're sitting there, and what felt like an eternity for us to start rolling, right? I was expecting, hey, I'm going to hop in this truck, and we're going to just immediately start going. We're going to get back. They're going to get me out of there. And the time that I'm sitting there, maybe a few minutes go by, but I'm able to kind of replay, okay, hey, what happened? What was going on? Where are the people at? Where's the threat still? And able to relay to my guys, of, hey, guys, like, look, like that's the route we've got to go. Like, this route's clear. I know because the people that were there are no longer there. So that's kind of the odd piece, is it slows down time and really lets you kind of focus, right? So narrows your focus on what the task at hand. I didn't think at any time about the injuries. I didn't think, oh, shoot, I'm shot in the face. Oh, shoot, I'm shot in the neck. I really just thought about, hey, can we get out of there? And can everyone safely navigate?
When the QRF rolled up, did you see them?
So I saw them passing. So we were driving by, so kind of a virtual handshake. The alleyway that the dude with RPG was in is the same alleyway they came up. So that was our route leaving, and literally they were pulling in as we were pulling out. So we were able to kind of high five. They took over the same location we were in, but they had tanks, so they weren't worried. They're armored. They can handle a little bit of RPGs, and from there they would have a better vantage point to help kind of squash the uprising.
When you got back to the FOB, what happened?
Yeah, so get back to the FOB, roll through the gate, and I get out of the vehicle. I say, hey, I'm gonna walk to the aid station. Immediately they see me, and they're like, no, get down on the stretcher. So hop me on a stretcher, pull me into the aid station. And immediately they're trying to piece together what happened. So initially, the initial reports, we all thought it was RPG, right? Because that's what we said. A lot of damage to the face. I had like a size of a baseball or softball on the side of my face, and I had a lot of damage to my neck. So they thought that we'd been hit by an RPG. So they were very worried about doing anything with the shrapnel. So they just wanted to stabilize me. And I remember looking up the division surgeon, very heavyset guy, was straddling me, and he had this very big needle because he thought, hey, my airway is going to close because my throat was wounded. So he wanted to basically start an airway on me. And I remember thinking in my head, like, no, I don't want you to do this because my fear was that he's going to hit my vocal cords and make it so I can't talk, right? Super stupid thing to worry about when life or death is in the balance, but that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking about is, hey, no, I'd like to still be able to talk. And so I'm shaking my head, no. And my medic is standing over in the corner. He's like, yeah, I don't think he wants you to do that. And the PA, so the physician assistant there, Doc Sullivan, God bless him. He's like, well, he's still breathing and he's talking. So I think his airway is fine. If they need to, they can handle that on the helicopter on the way out. So the whole time I'm just trying to remain calm. I'm asking, hey guys, I'm going to be okay. And of course, medics, they got to tell you, yep, you're going to be just fine. You're going to be just fine. And they're like, hey, helicopter's coming. So I hear the bird, the guys come out, they load me up and I pass out. As they're taking off, I fall asleep. They kept trying to wake me up. I'm falling asleep. And I'm like, I woke up in the green zone after my first surgery. So I was out. Cold, got there, they had to go in, give me some blood, they had to stop the bleeding, control the bleeding, and then I woke up to then go back into another surgery to help kind of figure out what the damage was. But yeah, it was a very weird sensation. You go from being on the middle of a battlefield shooting people to all of a sudden you're in a hospital setting with just dead silence. It's just weird. So trying to process, okay, what happened? What's the next steps? And then at the time, I still didn't know what had really happened to me. So it was just odd.
What happened in the hospital?
Yeah, so in the green zone, a couple of surgeries. First one, like I said, basically giving me blood, getting me stabilized. Second surgery was going and really figure out damage. And then packaged me up to send me up to launch tool. So at the green zone, they didn't have what they needed to do to go in and get the bullet. And remove the bullet and remove the fragments. The stuff in my neck, they were very, very scared about because they didn't too close to the carotid, too close to the jugular to do anything. So, hey, look, we've got to get you up into launch tool to where someone can go in and really do it properly. So literally I'm in there, I think a day I was there. My brigade command team came by, told me, hey, look, we're going to send you up to Germany and we're probably going to evacuate you home. You got a Purple Heart coming your way. We probably won't need to bring you back to finish the deployment. So I was like, okay. And then they say, hey, if you want, you can call your wife, let her know you're okay. So I did, which is awesome because my wife thought I was killed. right? So she's like, hey, she knew I'd been hurt, thought it was super serious, hadn't really heard anything. So calling her, letting her know, hey, look, I'm okay. It was nice. They offered to send her up to Germany. And I told her, you know, don't worry, like, stay home. We had a son. My son was like one at the time. So, hey, just stay home. I'll be home soon enough and we'll be fine. Go up to Germany, a couple of surgeries in Germany. They had to fix my sinuses, so put some splints in my nose, did some composite to kind of repair my face and really just kind of stabilize me again. And then I wound up flying back to the States for another couple surgeries. So all in all, I got hurt in August, and my last surgery was in April of 05 when they were done kind of putting me back together.
How was your wife notified?
Yeah, so a couple of ways, which at the time, the notification process within the Army, right, has its own system, right? The problem was we were very good friends with a lot of people in my platoon. So word got out that I'd been hit before the official notification process hit. So she was notified by the wife of one of my friends in the platoon who was out on mission with me. So one of the gunners told him, hey, Borman got hit. It didn't look good. Got shot in the face. Doesn't look good. So immediately she calls my wife, hey, your husband's been shot in the face. It doesn't look good. So of course she's thinking, oh shit, like he's dead. So she panics, doesn't know what to do. And then luckily the family readiness group was able to call her and say, hey, look, yeah, he was hurt. They stabilized him. And they think he's going to make a full recovery. So flash to bang, probably an hour and a half of just uncertainty of her just trying to process, like, what do I do? And then once she got the call that it was going to be okay, then she started calling my family. So calling my mom, calling my dad, and my relatives, let them know, hey, look, he got hurt. He's coming home. He's going to be okay.
How long did you wind up staying in Landstuhl?
A week. So I made it home on my birthday. So I got shot on the 11th, and I made it to stateside on the 18th. So a week from the time I got shot to the time I got home.
Was that a better birthday in the Army than the one at boot camp?
It was interesting, right? Yeah, I definitely better coming home, because, you know, they say that your life flashes before your eyes when you get shot. For me, it wasn't really my life. It was really just an image of my wife and son, right? It was an image of not wanting to leave them. So getting home and seeing them was huge.
What was that homecoming like?
It was interesting, right? So I will say the flight home was the worst flight of my life. I had hopped up on pain meds, hopped up on a morphine drip, but I had splints in my nose. So flying on a C-130, cabin pressure was horrible. I just... pain that I'd never ever experienced in my life, felt like my head was going to explode. So just hated the flight home. But then once we landed, there was probably about 15 people that had traveled back with me. Heroes welcome, right? We got, you know, standing ovations at the airport and all that, which was pretty awesome. I had never really seen that. We didn't get that off of any other deployment, so that was really cool. And then, you know, wife was super excited. My son was super happy. So it was really awesome to see kind of that support.
Did you want to go back immediately?
I did. So I felt bad. Like I felt like I still had a mission to complete, right? My guys were still there. They were still in it. And I thought I was okay. I thought, hey, I'm fine. I can go back. I didn't realize that it would take so long to repair me to be able to get back in the fight. But I was ready. I was like, hey, look, like I'm patched up. I'm not bleeding. Like, let me get back out there. Let's finish this deployment. I was only halfway through. So 6 months out of a 12-month deployment, I was like, hey, look, I got this. I got some payback I got to get. I want to find that sniper and get him back. But luckily, my unit was smarter. And I said, no, look, like take time to heal. By the time I was healed, they were already rolling back. So they came back in March.
What happened with White Platoon after you left?
Yeah, so White Platoon, they wound up getting a replacement for me. So we wound up getting a guy who was on staff, took over my gun truck, and it was a relatively quiet. So it was, they said that the action was hot for August, September, and then kind of died down. So no casualties. We were lucky. We were one of the few companies that didn't have any KIAs in its company. Knock on wood, it was awesome. But as far as, like, the action definitely died down. They had a few kind of close calls with a few incidents, but for the most part, they say, hey, that was really the peak of the fighting for the unit.
By the time 2005 rolls around, you've got to be getting close to your end of obligated service.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. So I was supposed to, I had really three options, right? So 2005 rolled around. I was on the E7 list. So I had made E7 in 7 years. So I was on track to be what I told everyone, Sergeant Major's Army, right? I was going to be the top dog on the enlisted side. I was going to take over the world. And at the time, the Army had really three things for me to look at. First one, they say, hey, look, like, you've got some serious injuries. You can take a medical discharge, right? So they say, hey, we can put you through the system, get you medically discharged. The next option was, hey, you want to reclass to something, you know, we can reclass you. Or the third option was, hey, you can maybe, you know, if you want to, you can go put in your packet for warrant officer or officer, right? If you want to make it a career, this is kind of your time to do it. So that's when I was kind of sitting back and trying to figure out, okay, what do I want to do in my life? My wife told me, like, hey, if you are going to stay in the Army, you can't be a tanker anymore. Like, she just couldn't handle me getting back on a plane, going back overseas, doing the same job. So while I was doing surgeries to recover, I also enrolled in classes. So I was taking college classes. I took the college tests, trying to get as many college credits as I can because I thought, hey, I'm going to go and do something different. I'm either going to go OCS or ROTC or go warrant officer. So I wanted to get an education. Which is funny because when I first came in the Army, the enlisted versus officer, especially on the armor side, it's this real big kind of power struggle, right? Because on tanks, the platoon leader and the platoon sergeant do darn near the same exact thing, right? They're both in command and control, and they both have tactics. So it's always this weird dichotomy of you have a platoon sergeant who's been doing it 15, 20 years, and you have this brand new platoon leader who's been doing it 1 to 2 years, right? Coming in and who's really in charge, right? And so on the enlisted side, we always say, hey, like, dark side of the Army is the officer side, right? Enlisted, we work for a living. Officers just make decisions. So I was at first dead set against going officer. So I was like, hey, I'm going to put in my packet. I want to go fly helicopters, right? I want to go be a Black Hawk pilot. They have the same engine as a tank. So I was like, I understand the engines. I wanted to fly medevac because I was like, hey, medevac saved my life. I want to do that. I get ready to do it. I had had the PRK to fix my vision before I deployed to Iraq. And at the time, they weren't sure if it was satisfiable. So they're like, nope, you can't fly. So I was like, okay, well, I can't go warrant then, because at the time, that's the only thing you could do for a warrant as an armor guy. You'd have to fly. I was like, all right, I guess I've got to go officer. So at the time, I was short. I would have needed 90 credit hours to go to OCS for degree completion. And they had an opportunity, which is called active duty option green and gold, where basically you go to school full time for 2 years while you're enlisted, and you wind up graduating and commissioning. So I was like, all right, there are 50 slots at the time. I was like, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring. If I get it, I get it. It's meant to be. If I don't, then I'm going to deploy. So in the meanwhile, I'm working on battalion staff as a battalion master gunner, getting gunnery densities, had gone off to ANOC, or senior leader course is what they're calling it now, but had gone off to school, and I was ready for in 06, we're supposed to deploy, right? So we're going to go right back to Iraq, kind of doing the same kind of mission. And I was going to take over a platoon. I was going to be a platoon sergeant in theater. So I was prepping, getting ready to do that. And I remember we were supposed to deploy September, October timeframe. And in August, I got called into my battalion commander's office. And I'm thinking, like, okay, he's going to tell me what platoon I'm taking and all this. He said, hey, I've got some good news and some bad news. I'm like, all right. I'm like, well, give me the bad news first. He's like, well, the bad news is you're not getting a platoon. I'm like, well, what the hell? Like, I don't want to do a deployment on battalion staff. Like, this is horrible. I'm like, all right, well, what's the good news then? He's like, well, the good news is you're going to go to school. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, yeah, you got selected for the active duty option. So I'm like, oh, awesome, okay. So instead of deploying, I started school September of 06. So I went to school full-time, got paid as sergeant first class, going to class, wound up getting a degree in corporate finance. And the fun thing is, The whole time I'm thinking, hey, I'm probably going to go back to some type of combat arms, right? Something that I know it'll be in my wheelhouse. It'll be super easy, fun to do. And the whole time my wife's saying, that's stupid. You should do something that's going to help you. And so I had had a phone call with my branch manager at the time for armor saying, hey, look, I'm looking to do this. He's like, hey, look, you're top of your class. Like you're going to get your first choice. You're a distinguished military graduate. Like, yeah, you're going to get your first duty assignment, all that stuff. So, hey, yeah, whatever you put down, you're going to get. He's like, but have you thought about finance? And I'm like, finance? No. No, I'm a tanker, man. What the heck are you talking about, finance? He's like, well, his good buddy was the commandant of the finance school, and they were struggling at the time. So it's 2008, and finance had a lot of officers that were getting into trouble, right? So they had an issue with discipline. They had an issue with officers stealing money, officers forging documents, and having inappropriate relationships. So he said, have you thought about doing something like finance? I'm like, well, not really. He's like, well, you have a finance degree. Maybe it'd be beneficial. So, of course, my wife's like, oh, yeah, do finance. That's awesome. So I'm like, okay, fine. So the way finance works, more than half of them get branch detail, right? So I was like, awesome. I'll go do finance, but the first 3 years I'll be on tanks. I'll get to have fun. And then when I'm a captain, I'll go do finance. So I put my stuff in. Yeah, I'll take branch transfer. I'll do all this stuff. The decision comes down, no, you're straight finance. I'm like, what? I don't get to do any tanks. So, which wound up being a good thing. So I commissioned finance. I go off to Fort Jackson, do the schoolhouse. And I'm thinking, like, this is just a totally different side of the Army, right? On tanks, we didn't have any women at the time on tanks. It was just a, you know, alpha male dominated type society. Everything is like super rugged, having fun, blowing stuff up. And then on the finance side, it was this weird gentleman's course, right? So I go there expecting to get yelled at, hemmed up, right? We're all lieutenants. No, it's like, hey, you'd show up, you'd do class. They never cussed you out. Everything was professional. And I'm like, this is really weird. I'm like, I don't know if this is going to be like what it's like when I go to my unit. So I wound up going right back to Fort Hood, and I was supposed to be a dispersing officer. So I show up. I'm like, hey, look, I'm here. What do you guys need me to do? I'm like, well, we have a deployment coming up to Kuwait. We're going to put you on it. I'm like, okay, there's three of us. I'm like, that's fine. I'll do a Kuwait deployment. That's cake. So support type deployment. And so I'm there. I train up, deploy downrange in March. And I arrive there in the detachment. I'm there. They're just split operations, three locations, but just have all kinds of issues, right? Little drama issues, discipline issues. Soldiers aren't working out. Soldiers aren't dealing with each other and just nitty-gritty little issues. I'm like, this is really weird. And so I'm like, just doing my job, like, hey, look, I'm gonna be the best dispersing officer, I'm gonna handle this cash, I'm gonna do what I gotta do. And in June, my commander got relieved, right? Had forged some documents, got fired, and the battalion commander's like, hey, Borman, yeah, we're downrange and there's no other captains. Do you wanna take command? I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, I'll take command, like, without a doubt. So literally, it's me in command of all these finance people. I still don't have a clue about finance, but I know about disciplines. I'm like, look, like, I might not know about the job, but one thing we're going to do is we're going to straighten up. So I was like, look, no matter what we do, standards and disciplines, the customer's always right. Like, we're going to do things right. So it's a very interesting kind of what I call a leadership challenge. We had everything from, you know, NCOs disrespecting NCOs, getting fist fights with each other, inappropriate relationships. We had people, we did health and welfare, found people with drugs. We had people, I had one of my soldiers was stealing money from customers. So I got to work with the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston to help close some of the loopholes that they were exploiting. So it was a very, very interesting, right, in a very short 6-month period of all of these types of things, like anything you could imagine to happen to a commander, I had in that small little thing. So deployed back to the States, and I'm thinking, awesome, I did my time, we're going to deactivate the unit, and that'll be it. I did my command time, I'm going to go do something else. So get back to the States, deactivate the unit, head off to Captain's Career Course, getting ready to go do some amazing things. And the Army's like, oh, hey, we're going to send you back to Fort Hood again. I'm like, holy cow, this is getting silly. All right, back to Hood. And I'm ready to start doing staff. I'm like, hey, look, I commanded already. I had like 18 months of command time under my belt. I'm supposed to do a staff position. They didn't have anything open. And another commander falls under investigation. So, of course, they're like, hey, Borman, you've done command. Go take command of this unit. They're going to do another Kuwait deployment. I'm like, awesome. I already know Kuwait. Yeah, I'll take command. I'm training up for Kuwait. And about 6 months prior, we get notified, oh, nope, change. Instead of Kuwait, you're going to go to Afghanistan. And instead of just one location, you're going to have split locations. Oh, and by the way, we're going to take all of your soldiers from you, and we're going to build a new company with just, like, deployable people. So I'm like, okay, so all the people I trained up with, all the people I've worked with, people that I know, all went to the four winds, and now we've got to build a team. So now instead of worried about, like, how do we do our job, I say, look, guys, like, all we're going to focus on is, like, how do we work together? So that's what we did. We just did a whole lot of, like, team-building type stuff we did. I said, hey, look, you got to be physically fit, mentally fit, and just prepared for a challenge. Because they're like, hey, Afghanistan is not Kuwait, right? The location we were going to was Bagram and Shank. And I knew Bagram was a massive site. So I'm like, hey, look, like, you guys are going to be running probably 24-hour ops. And Shank, only thing I knew about Shank is the nickname was Rocket City. So I'm like, look, guys, like, you have to be mentally prepared to just handle indirect fire on a daily basis. I said, trust me, I've been there, done that. I'll help you guys out. But the job itself isn't hard. We need to figure out how to work as a team. We need to quickly come together so that way we have each other's back on the deployment. So that's literally what we did. It's this whole 6 month train up is like, all right, 2-a-days for PT. We did a lot of cool events doing paintballing and go-karting and just things trying to get each other to understand each other and work as a team. So did that deployment. It was pretty awesome. Great unit.
Looking back on the injury, was that an inflection point in your career, or was that just another phase?
Yeah, right. Well, and that's the funny thing, right? So a lot of people ask me, like, you know, especially people when I talk to them, like, well, why don't you tell me you got shot? To me, it was just a day, right? I my mindset and my mentality is like, whatever happens in life is just an event, right? So I have never based my life around a single event. I think it's silly, right? I think that, you know, it's a stepping stone. So for me, I didn't dwell on it. I didn't focus it. I don't really think about it, right? It's something that happened, and it's something I got through, and it made me better. I've learned from it, and it's helped develop me. But I think what it did was it just gave me that understanding that life is short. And that you have to kind of make the most of it, right? So it if anything, it just re-energized me to do more with my life, right? Instead of just kind of doing what I had to do, to double down on sharing information and then double down on just doing more each day.
How have you brought that into your role here as a boxing instructor?
Yes. Yeah, so awesome opportunity, right? So I taught for a while at the schoolhouse down at Fort Jackson and realized I love teaching, right? I love helping people learn new things. So the opportunity, one of the people I worked with, my commander down in Afghanistan, she had taught in DPE and said, hey, look, you're all about physical fitness. You need to apply to West Point to go teach. So I honestly applied to everywhere. I applied to BSNL, SOSH, DPE. But like, I'll teach anything. Like, I don't care. Like, you're going to send me to school, I'll teach any subject. I love teaching. And I got selected for BSNL and SOSH on alternate and DP as a primary. So I'm like, well, if I would have gone to BSNL, I would have been teaching management or leadership. If I would have gone over to SOSH, I would have been teaching economics. So I'm like, well, I've already kind of taught those. I'm like, DPE, I've never taught any of those things. So I'm like, all right, let me just do this. So at the time, I didn't know I was going to be on the boxing committee. I had no idea how they did it because I wasn't a West Point grad, so no idea what to expect. And so I went off to school, I did a year at UVA, got my degree in kinesiology, which was awesome. And then came up here not knowing what to expect. Like, okay, hey, are we going to teach like PRT? Like, are we doing PT every day? Like, what do we teach? And I got a notification about a month prior to coming is, oh, hey, you're going to be a boxing instructor. I'm like, well, that's funny. Cause I've never boxed before. I've done kickboxing, taekwondo, jiu-jitsu, combat hapkido, wrestling, all those. But I said I never did like straight up stand-up boxing. So I'm like, okay, this will be fun. And it's awesome because the way it works here is they'll teach you everything you didn't know to teach, right? So I get here and Coach Barone, God bless him, he's been here forever, right? And he's like, look, I'm going to teach you everything you need to know about boxing. So the ability to quickly learn and then implement is awesome. And the cool thing about boxing here at the academy is everyone has to take it, right? So men and women take boxing now. That wasn't the case before, but it is now. And it's one of the first classes they take here, right? So everyone, as long as they're physically able, takes it their freshman year or their plebe year, right? So I love boxing because it is a stepping stone to the warrior ethos, right? So in the Army, we have the Soldier Creed, and nested within the Soldier Creed is that warrior ethos, right? I'll always play submission first. I'll never quit. I'll never accept defeat. I'll never leave a fallen comrade, right? So those two stanzas in the middle, right? I will never quit, and I will never accept defeat, tied directly to boxing, right? If you get in a boxing ring and you quit, you're going to get your ass handed to you, right? You're just going to get beat up. Like, you aren't saved until the bell. If you accept defeat, if you get your butt kicked in the first round and you don't come back with some fire in the second, you're just going to get your butt kicked again, right? So it is a real world capability for me to really stress the importance of, hey, look, guys, you're going to be future warrior leaders, right? You're going to be leading soldiers in combat. And out of the academy, the majority of the cadets are going combat arms. So I said, look, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when you're put in that. And you have to be able to physically bite down on your mouthpiece and engage. You can't get scared and run away, right? If that happens on the battlefield, and I've seen people do it, right? We've been in contact, and I've seen people tuck up, curl in a ball, start crying. I've seen people want to leave. You will get people killed, or you will get yourself killed, right? So being able to really show them, hey, look, not only is this an activity, but this is also real-world applications. This really tells you, hey, look, this lets you know, how do you manage your fear? How do you manage your aggression? How can you keep a level head while you're still trying to attack the opponent? And for most of them, the opponents are their friends, right? I've had cousins fight each other. I've had twins fight each other. I've had company mates fight each other, teammates fight each other. So the odds are the person you're trying to attack isn't necessarily the enemy. It's a friend. So if you can bite down and engage your friend, I have no doubts that you can bite down and engage the enemy.
As you build that warrior ethos in cadets, are there other elements that you use from that day in Iraq to teach?
Yeah, so I use kind of as I build out the warrior ethos, what I refer to as a warrior ethos is that will to win, right? So I look at all of the experiences, all of the knowledge, all of the skills, all of the attributes that I've learned throughout my military career, and I really apply that to all aspects of life, right? So not just what you need in the ring, not just what you need on your mission, not just what you need in the Army, right? They're applicable to life, right? So I'm retiring in April of 22. So I'm getting ready, you know, to go join the corporate world, right? The mystery that is the civilianized, you know. So in the process, I was like, hey, look, like, this is beneficial, not just for me, like, it's beneficial for everyone. So that's literally what I'm doing is during my terminal leave, I'm writing a book called Ethos of Warrior, right? Forging a Will to Win, where we look at all of the attributes that I've kind of gained throughout my military career, right? And how can they be applicable, not just in the Army, but in life in general, right? How can discipline, how can, you know, fear management, personal courage, grit, resilience, all those kind of traits and characteristics that you pick up along the way, how can you apply those to all the other areas of your life?
John, we look forward to seeing that book when it comes out. Thanks for being our guest on The Spear today.
Awesome. Been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.